Yes, Gary, I'll say something about that. Well, first of all, the time is really ripe for reassertion of a rule of law approach to nuclear weapons and to their disarmament. That's for various reasons, some of which Alan has already referred to: international humanitarian law, IHL, getting renewed play in the non-proliferation treaty context, and a boost from the Red Cross, Red Crescent movement, which had stayed out of this issue essentially for decades because they were being told by the major powers, we don't want to hear from you on this, and the Red Cross thought they had other things they wanted to accomplish. And there's also various elite initiatives, the Global Zero, George Shultz and colleagues at the Hoover Institute, who have been fairly successful in raising the problem of nuclear weapons and the need for their at least eventual abolition around the world. So I do think it's a good time to really hammer on the rule of law approach. Whether going back to the International Court of Justice is a good way to do it, it is certainly worth discussing. My organization, the International Association of Lawyers Against Nuclear Arms, IALANA, and my office in New York serves as the UN office for IALANA, the last decade worked fairly hard on an initiative to return to the court. We did a memo, and I'll send the link to it via chat, which essentially was proposing that another advisory opinion be sought from the court on the question of compliance with the nuclear disarmament obligation. So not asking the court directly to revisit issues regarding threat or use of nuclear weapons, but rather asking the court, are governments in compliance with the nuclear disarmament obligation articulated by the court and based in particular on Non-Proliferation Treaty Article 6. We had some interest from leading non-aligned movement countries in this initiative, but eventually they decided not to go forward with it. In the meantime, we had Obama come in, and we had the 2010 NPT Review Conference, which reasserted commitments to disarmament and included some new ones that made reference to the necessity of establishing a framework for a world without nuclear weapons. So as far as governments go, as you can well imagine, you know, they have some reluctance about this. Partly they say, well, we already have a good statement from the ICJ on the obligation of nuclear disarmament, and it's being ignored. So what will we accomplish by having the court delve into this again? That's, you know, that's one concern they have. And of course, they're always balancing various strategies they can pursue, and there's certainly a focus on what can be accomplished at the 2010 NPT Review Conference. There are certain things about the what can be accomplished at the 2015 Review Conference. There are certain provisions in the 2010 NPT outcome which point towards 2015. So one aspect that we have considered emphasizing is that all states possessing nuclear weapons, well, we don't really know exactly what's happening in North Korea, but essentially all states possessing nuclear weapons are engaged in programs of modernizing to maintain and sometimes to improve their nuclear weapons capabilities, the infrastructure, the delivery systems, the warheads and bombs themselves, with horizons of several decades, which they openly state in their planning documents. So a question that, at least one question that can be posed to the court, and multiple questions can be put to the court, would be, is this modernization consistent with the nuclear disarmament obligation in various commitments that have been made in the NPT context in particular. Now, I'll send around a recent publication which has a great deal of information analysis on this. Gary, I think that a paper of mine which deals with some issues regarding how nuclear deterrence undermines international law was circulated, and I could make a few points from that as well, or I can stop here. It's up to you.
John, your paper was circulated, but we did it late, so I'm sure a number of people haven't had a chance to go through it yet, and I thought it's very relevant to this discussion. So please do continue.
Okay, let me just pull a few main points out of the paper. Everybody on this call, unlike the general public, understands the UN Charter approach to use of force. And there's a basic fact that perhaps has been obvious to you, but had to some degree escaped my notice for many years. And sometimes the most basic and simple truths are the ones that are hardest to see. And if we take nuclear deterrence in the way that it's presented by states possessing them, it's supposed to be a mechanism for prevention of major war and for preservation of international stability. Nuclear deterrence brings peace is the short version of how they present it. But assuming that's how it should be characterized, and obviously I don't characterize it that way, but just assuming it for a moment, reliance on deterrence, nuclear deterrence, as an international security mechanism is very, very, very far removed from the world envisaged by the UN Charter, in which threat or use of force is the exception, not the rule. International security allegedly provided by nuclear deterrence with the permanent ongoing threat of force every day is the inverse of the world envisaged by the Charter. It turns the UN Charter on its head. Now, there's another way that nuclear deterrence is contrary to and undermines the UN Charter, and that is that as it's now practiced, it's understood to involve major powers. Other states are excluded and cannot acquire nuclear weapons. This is the rule of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. However, a just and therefore sustainable legal order requires that the same rules apply to all. One manifestation of the instability caused by the possession of nuclear weapons by some states but not others is the doctrine of preventive war. That doctrine was put into practice in the Iraq invasion and the recent Israeli strike on Syria and is raised with respect to Iran. Preventive war is contrary to the UN Charter. Considering the subsequent rise of preventive war, the International Court of Justice was prophetic in its 1996 opinion when it said, and I quote, "In the long run, international law, and with it the stability of the international order which it is intended to govern, are bound to suffer from the continuing difference of views with regard to the legal status of weapons as deadly as nuclear weapons." So my comment is this, nuclear deterrence in its corollary, preventive war to prevent proliferation, is profoundly corrosive of the UN Charter.
Yeah, that's more for more.
There are also distorting effects of ongoing reliance on nuclear weapons with respect to major instruments of international criminal law and the international law of armed conflict. And I think you'll see that the thrust of my remarks is not so much to say that nuclear deterrence is really, really dangerous, that someday nuclear weapons are going to be used, and so on, all of which I believe. But it's to say, assume nuclear deterrence goes on as it has been, it is really distorting and undermining the international law that we need with respect to international criminal law, international law of armed conflict, and less directly other issues that the world needs to address, finance, climate change, etc. And in my paper, I explain how the existence of nuclear weapons distorted the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court. We wound up with the absurd situation in which use of poison and expanding bullets is per se, as such, a war crime, but not biological, chemical, or nuclear weapons. And yet the case with regard to biological weapons and chemical weapons was absolutely clear-cut because of the existence of universal treaties on those weapons. Let me just interject that under the general definitions of war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide, typical uses of nuclear weapons would nonetheless be international crimes for which responsible individuals could be prosecuted. Now, there's also been a distorting and undermining effect of nuclear weapons with respect to the main instruments of international humanitarian law. And I have in mind Protocol 1 to the Geneva Conventions, and my paper mentions that. Now, the second part of my remarks, it's not really papers, just remarks I gave last week, goes into how developments in international law facilitate nuclear disarmament. And Alan has already talked about the reassertion of IHL in the nuclear weapons context. And of course, we now have the International Criminal Court. In the United States, the application of IHL has become a standard part of military operations with lawyers directly involved in targeting decisions, just for example. I'm not saying that IHL is necessarily correctly interpreted or implied, but it's definitely a standard part of military operations. So both at the international and national levels, we see the rise of IHL, and it's just completely, along with human rights, both IHL and human rights are just completely out of sync, completely incompatible with the world in which there's ongoing reliance on nuclear weapons. The prospects for the UN system, I'm thinking in particular of the Security Council, are, to say the least, uncertain at this time. We've been seeing threat diplomacy regarding Iran, as Richard Falk calls it. That, in and of itself, is contrary to the Charter, let alone a preventive war of some kind. So there's definitely a challenge with respect to the Security Council and related to the General Assembly. And I don't really like to set preconditions for achieving the abolition of nuclear weapons, but I think we're going to need a reformed and more representative Security Council where the veto is restricted if we're going to successfully abolish nuclear weapons. That is it.